Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Wealth, not income, determines our financial security. Tough times will come, but how much of a cushion do you have in order to get through them? And there's an enormous gap between the races when it comes to wealth. For every dollar that a white family has saved, an African-American family has 16 cents. And it's even worse for women. For every dollar of wealth owned by white women, black and Hispanic women have a fraction of a penny. Why? And how do we get more money into their banks? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, March 17th. And you know, that's a simple concept, but it makes a big difference. It's not your income. It's how much you have in the bank that really determines your security.
And it seems like there's more than a few rungs missing on the economic ladder in this country, that's for sure. Let's get a check of the top morning's news. The FBI says now that confused hitmen may have gone to the wrong party and killed the wrong people in the Mexican city of Juarez last weekend. Three people with ties to the U.S. Embassy were killed in the brutal drive-by shooting we've been reporting on all week. And we're learning these details this morning. The FBI says there's no evidence that the victims were targeted because they were employed at the U.S. consulate. Here at home, some religious leaders are telling undocumented immigrants not to fill out census forms. The Reverend Miguel Rivera is the chairman of a coalition of 20,000 churches.
How in the world are we going to ask undocumented immigrants to trust and to open the door where they have no assurances that that information will be confidential? I will not be used against them.
Other religious leaders say that entire boycott process is counterproductive.
Meanwhile, the Homeland Security Department is cutting millions of dollars intended for a high-tech virtual fence along the Mexican border. Secretary Napolitano says about $50 million in stimulus money will go toward radios and cameras instead. We're looking this morning at the racial gap in terms of wealth in this country, specifically how minority women are doing financially compared to their white counterparts. And we're joined now by Esther Bush. She's the president and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Pittsburgh. She actually works in financial literacy for the urban poor and explaining to them how to save their money. Good morning, Esther.
Good morning.
Those numbers I cited at the top of the show are from a new study that I know you've looked at, and I'm wondering if you were surprised by this wide gap, how wide this gap is between black and Hispanic women and their white counterparts.
Yes, I knew the gap was wide, but it is even worse than I had predicted. There are things that we really need to address in this country to close that gap.
Okay, we're going to be asking you what those things are in a moment. Esther Bush, stay with us.
In Israel, tensions remain high this morning after violence on the streets in Jerusalem yesterday. Meanwhile, the White House has reiterated its strong bonds with the government of Prime Minister Netanyahu. Earlier, we spoke with Professor Ilan Peleg of the Middle East Institute. He said Netanyahu's position right now between right-wing lawmakers and Washington is tough.
On the one hand, he has his commitment to his ideology. On the other hand, he has enormous amount of international pressure.
The Prime Minister of Israel will visit Washington next week. Here at home, Health Secretary Kathleen Sebelius says it looks like things are on track for a House vote on health care reform either Friday or Saturday. Democrats still appear to be short of the 216 votes they need in the House.
And the number of people in state prisons has dropped for the first time in nearly 40 years. A small decrease, the Pew Center reports, a drop of just 0.4% in many states. That's because of budget problems, which are forcing the states to let prison inmates go early. There are nearly a million and a half inmates in state prisons across the nation. Taking a look at the markets, futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,685, the S&P at 1,159, and the NASDAQ at 2,378. Well, we have a new series this week. It's called DIY Bailout, how you can help yourself out of financial rough times. And it's important to accept the help when it's needed. And part of that is talking about finances. Do you have trouble talking about your money, how much you make, how much you owe? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Are there financial taboo topics? TheTakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Income does not equal wealth. That's because between the amount of your paycheck and how much you actually put in the bank, there's all those other things like your debt and your expenses that you have to pay. You may not be able to keep much of your income. But wealth means financial security. So what we now know is that there's actually a racial gap when it comes to employment. But even for those who are employed, for those who have a good income, there's still a racial gap in terms of wealth. And it's especially bad for women of color. Here are some of the numbers, not including the cars they own. Let's set cars aside. The average single white woman has about $4,000 in assets. The average Hispanic woman has $120. And the average African-American woman, only about $100. We've got Ella Edmondson-Bell with us to talk about this. She's a professor of business administration at Dartmouth's Tuck School, and she joins us from North Carolina. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can you explain to me why this is? Why is there such a vast gap between the races on the issue of wealth?
Well, I think one reason is that there is such a thing as generational wealth, wealth that is passed down from our parents, our grandparents, African-American women, Hispanic women, we come from families where there is not, where we don't get a leg up from generational wealth because our parents and our grandparents didn't have that wealth to pass down to us. So we start at the short end of the stick. The next problem is that we are in industries and in jobs that do not give us the good fringe benefits. We don't get the big bonuses. We don't get good pension plans. We don't get health plans. So those monies have to be put out in other ways. So not only do we not bring it in terms of salary, we're not getting the fringe benefits that often come with salary that allows us to put more money away.
Ella, there's also another issue that I was interested to read about, and that's that sometimes the expenses themselves are higher. For example, there's a lot of instances of redlining in urban communities on the parts of insurance companies. So they're paying higher insurance rate for their homes and their cars. Their expenses are higher.
And if you look at the latest mortgage fiasco, many African-American women were caught up on that in terms of the types of mortgages that they were able to get, and that those mortgages were the high prime mortgages, subprime mortgages, and fell through the cracks and required much more money with less house. And then there's the other reality that many of the women we're talking about are either single, divorced, and single heads of households. So there's not a double income there to consider. So there's even less money to put away. A woman is responsible for not only providing food, clothing, and shelter, but daycare and everything else for her family on a very low income rate.
Okay, so there's a lot of contributing factors here.
There's a lot of contributing factors, and this should not come as a big, big surprise, to be honest with you.
Okay, let's go back to Esther Bush, who heads the Urban League of Greater Pittsburgh. Esther, you take all these contributing factors, and you say, well, listen, there's still things that you can do about that, right? For this public that you serve, the community that you serve, you're trying to help them out through financial literacy, trying to help them get better mortgages, get better loans, right?
Absolutely. And the information that was just shared, we see it every single day. And it's important for your entire listening audience to understand the impact of all of those things over decades and generations. Right now, we have a mortgage foreclosure program with women coming in, and it is some of the deals that the mortgage owners are trying to have these women sign are unbelievable. I even took a couple of them to my board meeting, and the head of my board, who is an attorney, he read the paper and literally opened his mouth. He could not believe that a firm, a bank, a mortgage company was asking somebody to sign papers that if my mortgage is $300 today and I can't pay it, how am I going to pay you $450 over the next X amount of months to catch up? So even some of the remedies are just really, truly ridiculous. And the way things are designed, they're designed seemingly to keep these women and other poor, low-income people in the hole.
Okay, well, explain to me, what are the number one and number two things that someone can do who's in this situation? Maybe somebody has a good income and they want to start building their assets and building their wealth. What are the first things they should do?
The first thing they should do is put themselves on a budget, and no matter the amount of their income, make sure that they put aside something to save. People always say, or typically say, you know, I don't make enough to save. Yes, you do. If it's $5 a paycheck, if it's $10, until you can get up to $100 or whatever is affordable for you, because what's critically important is to begin the habit, is to begin to understand the critical importance of savings and understanding how that savings can swell over time.
Okay, Ella, explain to me, is there a cultural gap here as well? We're talking about minority communities in which Esther is talking about a financial literacy problem where she's trying to help them get loans that are to their advantage and help them get fair insurance rates. Is there a cultural gap?
I think there is an exposure issue. If my mother and father had to work doubly hard just to keep a roof over my head, make sure I was fed, we didn't talk about necessarily savings. We didn't talk about stock. We didn't talk about investment. I think that is an issue that plagues our community. We are in a position where we don't have a lot of extra income at all. So ways that we can build wealth, particularly ways that whites have the opportunity to do because they've been exposed early on. I mean, many of my students, for example, at the Tuck School of Business have had stocks since they were children. That was an event, a game that they had with their parents. Each birthday, they got shares in stock and would follow it. You don't have that in our communities because we just don't have the knowledge, but we also don't have the monies to put aside like that, quite honestly. So the ways that whites in their culture, many of them who can build wealth, we just don't have access.
You got to find the ways to talk about it. That's Ella Edmondson Bell, professor of business at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business, author of Career GPS, and Esther Bush, president and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Pittsburgh. It's 15 minutes past the hour now. Let's check in on the headlines.
We'll go to Washington first. It's another day of health care reform arm twisting as President Obama sits down with wavering or reluctant House Democrats today. Opponents continue to run ad campaigns to kill the current bill. One senator is quoted by the Associated Press as saying the frenzy over health care gives new meaning to March Madness. Meanwhile, the Senate is expected to pass a jobs bill and send it to the president today. The legislation contains about $18 billion in tax breaks and around $20 billion to highway and transit programs. New twist on the China Google story this morning. Chinese companies that sell advertising space on Google's internet search engine have asked the company to provide clear information on its future plans. They want compensation if Google shuts down its China-based operations. 27 companies sent the appeal. Earlier this year, Google said it would no longer cooperate with China's rules, the government rules anyway, China's rules on internet censorship.
Here at home, religious leaders disagree on whether undocumented immigrants in their congregation should complete census forms. Reverend Samuel Rodriguez says any kind of boycott would be foolish.
If we boycott the census, we're boycotting representation, number one. Number two, we are boycotting funds and resources for better schools, more police officers, community development.
And finally, it is St. Patrick's Day, and in Ireland, there's a severe shamrock shortage threatening St. Patrick's Day festivities. That's according to the head botanist at the Royal Irish Academy. Dr. Declan Doug says the plant was hit hard by severe winter weather this year. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, the return of Tiger. Tiger Woods going back to golf.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Big money in both of our takeouts this segment. Louise Story joins us, Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times, to talk about the Fed and its future. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning.
And Tiger's return to golf is the subject of Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen sitting here looking very snappily dressed this morning, I should say. Good morning, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
Louise, let's talk about what the Fed did yesterday. This morning, Ben Bernanke is going to be defending the Fed's authority from bills to change financial regulation in the United States. But yesterday, the Fed left its short-term interest rate unchanged and really signaled that the status quo is where they're going to stick right now. First of all, what are the details?
That's right, John. So whenever you look at what the Fed does, you have to put on your linguistic hat and read the language. And the language yesterday was they will keep rates exceptionally low for an extended period. Those two phrases are key to everyone on Wall Street because those phrases have been telling us for about a year now that rates will not go up for many, many months. Already this morning we saw the Asian markets are up. This is something that people are taking as good news because keeping rates down indicate that they think the economy is improving, as they said yesterday.
Now, does this ratchet up the pressure? I mean, the range of 0 to 0.25% is where interest rates are now. It's like way, 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 way low. You mentioned Wall Street's watching this. In fact, the entire world is watching this. And when you've got Moody's worried about the U.S. credit rating and the Fed continuing to signal that it's going to keep buying mortgage-backed securities, this isn't really sustainable, is it?
Well, there are a few people, even within the Fed, worried. The president of the Kansas City Fed has been saying that he is concerned about inflation. The overall Fed board said they think inflation's under control. Actually, this month, one of the biggest things they'll be doing is they will be ending their purchase of mortgage-backed securities. You know, they have this $1.25 trillion plan where they've been doing that. It's been keeping mortgage rates low, but they will be ending that this month. And so that's something that you need to watch in the housing market, whether mortgage rates go up and whether it makes it harder to buy a home.
Now, until the end of the month, they're going to buy these mortgage-backed securities, which are keeping the whole housing industry afloat. Do you really believe they're going to end it? I mean, it's on paper that they're going to end it, but that's a really risky move there.
Well, they said yesterday that they do plan to end it. So I think that unless something major happens in the next few weeks, they will end it. Of course, the Fed's done a lot of unprecedented things during this recession, so they could bring it back or they could start a new program if trouble comes up again.
And we'll know in a month after they stop the mortgage buying program whether it does have an impact on the housing market. And as you say, they could put it right back on, correct?
That's right.
All right. The Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter, watching the Fed for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks, Louise.
Well, one guy who's hoping trouble does not come back again, it would be Tiger Woods, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. You're here actually to talk about Tiger's return to golf and whether or not he's going to be able to be as strong in golf as he has in the past is the big question. Is it not? Will he be able to retain his focus in light of all the things that have happened to him?
Well, this is the first time he's going to be playing on a golf course in competition since November 15th when he won the Australian Masters in Melbourne. That was his 82nd career victory. So now he's returning after all the scandal, after all the treatment. And I think this is the ideal place for him to return because Augusta really controls the environment for the Masters. So if you heckle, if you're out of line, you get kicked out. It's not like the U.S. Open where it's just kind of like this massive stuff.
Still, I mean, it's like being under a microscope and in a stadium at the same time.
And I think he knows this course well. He's played here. He's played extremely well here. So I think this is the ideal setting for Tiger to return. And like I said before, when this first came out, I have a feeling Tiger's going to play extremely well. He doesn't really know how to be a father or a husband. Those are all new things to him. But out of all the things that he knows how to do, he knows how to play golf. And now that he'll get back into a competition arena, I think he's going to play extremely well.
You don't think that this has shaken him? And I mean, golf, John was saying this morning, golf is really about focus, about quieting your mind and just focusing.
I think this is part of he's still in treatment. So he says that he's still in treatment. He's still going through this making the changes in his personal life. This is actually, to me, part of his treatment. If he can sort of hone in and focus, I think for him, golf is a meditative space and a meditative state. And he'll have the chatter from being a cheat and a liar in his personal life away. So this will kind of, the seas are kind of parted personally for him. So I think he's going to actually be able to focus even more because it's kind of like what happened with A-Rod where he was using steroids and he wasn't playing as well. Well, now all that stuff quieted away, and he was able to really focus on the game.
And Tiger Woods is a practicing Buddhist. I mean, you got to figure maybe he's going to bring a busload of Buddhist priests along to sort of stay behind him, to kind of crowd around him, to keep him quiet.
No, wait, the Dalai Lama didn't even know who Tiger Woods was. Let's be clear.
That's very Buddhist. You have to admit, that's very Buddhist.
It is very Buddhist. But, you know, here's the thing. Tiger is going to be under more the pressure is higher now than ever before, because if he fails, it's so predictable. His entire life, you know, crashes and burns. He just, you know, he was once great and now will wash up. And yet, if he succeeds, everyone says, well, he's put that all behind him and he can get back to, I mean, the pressure, the stakes could not be higher.
The most important thing for him to do is make the cut. And I think for the television ratings, this is going to be critical. This is going to be a huge, one of the most watched golf matches, tournaments in history because of Tiger's return. So I think,
unless he's out in the first round.
Exactly. So I think the focus is for Tiger. If Tiger does well early on and he makes the cut and he gets into the, starts to do well early, then we'll see. Then we can start talking about Tiger winning, and that'll create this huge storm of energy and interest. So I think for him, he's just focusing on what's in front of him.
It's almost the only way he's going to be able to put this behind him.
Without a doubt.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. Ibrahim, we're posting your NCAA March Madness predictions on the web, are we not?
Yes, and it was very difficult. There were some matchups that were hard to call.
What's the hardest one?
Well, I think in the East bracket, Kentucky versus West Virginia to get into the Final Four is tough. And then the entire Midwest bracket is a really difficult bracket.
It's a
big West Virginia constituency on our staff.
And that's tough.
Well, I don't know. She's only about 5'2", 5'3". She's not that big. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. Coming up, the healthcare battle could be ending soon. How did we get here? The beginning, the middle, of the end of the story on healthcare.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, the Obama administration and the narrative of health care reform. It's been a challenging narrative throughout American history, and we're going to take a look at this story that still doesn't have an ending yet. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. Undocumented immigrants are getting conflicting advice from church leaders on whether to fill out census forms. The Reverend Miguel Rivera, the chairman of a coalition of 20,000 churches, says he's telling people not to fill out forms until the government promises explicitly not to use that information against them.
I got information from our regional vice presidents that confirmed me that between 3 million to 3.5 million members of our churches will not participate in the census.
Meanwhile, another clergyman, the Reverend Samuel Rodriguez, says that whole boycott plan is just counterproductive.
The question is, if census information will be used to deport undocumented individuals in our country, will census information be used to prosecute or persecute people in our community? And the answer is no.
Well, undocumented immigrants and the rest of Americans will get to decide that as census forms begin arriving in mailboxes across the country this week.
The Pentagon is trying to curb the abuse of painkillers by soldiers. Military doctors wrote almost 4 million prescriptions for painkillers last year. That's more than four times the doses handed out in 2001. Military officials say, though, the increase in pain medication reflects the continuing toll of fighting two major wars. Painkillers were the target of an elaborate heist in Enfield, Connecticut. Using tactics more commonly used in going after diamonds or gold, the robbers cut a hole in the roof of a warehouse, rappelled inside, and stole $75 million worth of pain medication. Experts call it one of the largest pharmaceutical heists in history. And for the first time, Facebook has edged out Google as the most visited website in the United States. Facebook previously had reached the number one rank on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and a few other days, but it never kept the top spot for a full week. Until now, Facebook accounted for more than 7% of all internet visits in the U.S. last week. Taking a check on the markets, Asian and European markets are up, and futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,685, the S&P at 1,159, the NASDAQ opens at 2,378. Those are some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
Good morning, everyone. We're joined now by Michael Kirk, who's a frontline producer, and on April 13th, his film Obama's Deal will air. Frontline, of course, is a production of our partner WGBH in Boston. Good morning, Michael Kirk.
Good morning, John.
Who joins us from the Boston area, and you don't have an ending to this film, do you yet?
Not yet, and I'm crossing my fingers one way or the other. The film will end, but it's whether it's a, a happy ending for the president or a less happy ending.
And the happy ending also would refer either, depending on how you believe politically, for all American citizens who have something at stake in this debate. Michael Kirk, it seems to me, and we've got some excerpts from your film. Here's Dan Pfeiffer, a White House communications director, and this comes directly from your film, which is currently in the edit room right now, that the stakes of this entire battle here are pretty neatly laid out in this remark right here.
We were sitting in the Oval Office as we were sort of having a debate around health care at one point. The president said, it's about health care, but it's not really about health care. It's also about proving whether we can still solve big problems in this country. And this was going to be the test case for that.
Now, Michael Kirk, when did that meeting take place that Dan Pfeiffer is referring to? And did the president really launch this entire narrative by saying, can we solve big problems in the United States anymore?
Well, he launched it, I think, way back when he was running for the presidency and said and promised to try to change the culture and the way of operating in Washington. Healthcare, I think, was his test case, the case study that he would use to try to change the narrative of the way the pernicious politics of our country have been run for a number of presidencies. This particular meeting happened very early in the presidency when Joe Biden and others sat around and said, absolutely not. Don't take on universal health care. I've seen it eat too many presidencies alive.
Wow.
At the same time that Geithner and Summers were sitting in there saying, we've got an economy that's crashing. You got to pay attention to job one. But President Obama wanted an issue that he thought could demonstrate how different his presidency would be, and health care became that issue.
And he began to acquire the allies who would help to shape that message and to shape the entire narrative going forward. What's the first milestone, as you see it in this story, really, and it begins right after the election?
It's a very interesting case of an outsider suddenly surrounding himself, because I think he probably realized he had to, and the advice he was receiving was he had to. He had surrounded himself with insiders, former people who had worked in Congress all around the West Wing, including Rahm Emanuel, his chief of staff. But the primary person he brought in was one of the great Washington quintessential insiders, Tom Daschle, who'd been the majority leader for the Democrats and had been unelected by the people in his home state, and was at the time a health care lobbyist, or not a lobbyist legally, but a person who advocated for health care groups in Washington and very well known to the president.
And, you know, as you say, former majority leader in the Senate and a powerful person in Washington, and some have called him the most knowledgeable person on health care. But almost immediately that choice went south. Here's Jon Stewart on The Daily Show on February 2nd, 2009.
I do want to say a quick word to anyone out there who wants to bring change and hope to a deeply divided and suffering America. Pay your f***ing taxes. We're not asking you to be perfect. You want to be in the cabinet? We're not saying you can't throw a little under the table to the Guatemalan nanny. You're not saying you can't accept a couple of thanks for your help fruit baskets from the boys down at Local 238. But Tom Daschle? Obama's pick for health secretary?
Here, Michael Kirk, frontline producer, you see the cynicism that now suffuses this entire debate on health care reform starting to sweep in.
It begins literally, it's a great clip because it begins literally right at that moment. He's less than a month in, and he loses his primary point person on the issue because of the not only taxes, but he gets Daschle gets eaten alive by a rival in the Senate, Max Baucus, and Baucus's kind of partner on the Senate Finance Committee, the Republican Senator Charles Grassley.
And if the original turning point in this debate was the acquisition of Rahm Emanuel as sort of chief of staff for the president, someone with a aggressive reputation for working on Capitol Hill, the demise of Tom Daschle being another turning point, things really, really turned in the summer of 2009. Describe what you think is the critical turning point in the summer of 2009.
One of the things that Obama needed if he was going to get the bill passed was speed. It had to happen while the new president still had some juice. What happened with the Republicans was they intentionally slowed it down so that across the summer it was like heavy boots walking in mud over at Congress to try to get anything done. What they were essentially doing...
Here's the sound of some of those boots. This comes directly from your film. Do you think the president walked into this?
I think he did, sort of unknowingly. They hadn't really anticipated the anger and the fervor and the ability of Republicans and others, including indigenous movements, I guess indigenous movements like the Tea Party movement, to stoke it up and make it happen when Congress went home in August. And that really took it right to the precipice, that is the health care bill.
Well, your film will air April 13th, where we will know the outcome here. Where do you think we are right now before we go, Michael Kirk?
I think we're right on the edge, John. I think the president is counting votes. If he had them, there'd be a vote on it. We'd be hearing about it right now. He still doesn't have them even a year into this process.
If you had a camera anywhere in Washington right now, where would you want it?
I'd be right over Rahm Emanuel's shoulder.
Michael Kerr, well, there may be some of those POV shots in the frontline. Obama's Deal, produced by director Michael Kirk, frontline producer for the forthcoming documentary Obama's Deal, broadcast by Frontline, by our member station and partner WGBH on April 13th. Thank you, Michael.
You're welcome, John.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. One way that we know that the Detroit public schools are in crisis is that they have an emergency financial manager. His name is Robert Bob. Another way that we know that is that Robert Bob has announced the city will close 45 more schools this year. This is part of his plan, Robert Bob's plan, to fix the city's failing school system. And to talk more about it, we have Noah Ovshinsky from Detroit. He's an education reporter for our member station, WDET. And Noah, you've been covering the Detroit City Schools pretty much for as long as you've been reporting in Detroit. So tell me about this plan to close 45 schools. Is that a positive thing, or is this kind of an indication that the school system is dying?
Well, Celeste, it depends on what side you fall on. If you're a student or a parent, in the short term, it means a lot of disruption. It means that if you're a student that's been in DPS for at least 5 or 6 years, chances are you've moved schools at least once. So there is a lot of disruption that comes with this plan. If you're the district, it means you're saving a lot of money. This $31 million alone, if they close the full 45 buildings this year. So it all depends on what side of the line you fall on.
I would imagine that some of this is just related to the fact that the population of the city of Detroit has shrunk, that this is a city that was built to accommodate millions of people and now has maybe 800 or 900,000 people in it.
Yeah, to give you a flavor of the situation, Celeste, the district has 84,000 students this year. It's lost about 10,000 students a year for the last decade, and they're expecting enrollment to drop to as low as 56,000 by 2014. So there is a need to shrink the physical size of the district only because there are so many empty seats. That's due to declining enrollment. That's due to parents losing their job and moving out of the city, or students going to other districts outside of DPS. They live in the city, but they go to charters and private schools and parochial schools.
Well, here is Robert Bob telling reporters about this plan to shrink the school system.
We must reduce and eliminate our deficit. We must cut non-critical spending to create a smaller, more agile system with increased flexibility, credibility, and accountability.
Okay, and part of this more agile system means that people are going to be losing their jobs.
Yeah, we don't know exactly how many and what kind of jobs are going to be lost. We know that when you eliminate 45 buildings, many of those schools, you're going to lose teachers, you're going to lose principals and assistant principals and engineers. So yeah, there's going to be a lot fewer people working in the district if this plan goes through. That said, the academic nature of the district is going to change drastically. Most of the schools now will be pre-K through 8, which is an increasing movement throughout the country. And also, they're going to create larger campuses from pre-K through full colleges. They're going to bring colleges in on some of these big campuses to teach classes to some of their students.
How much is the Detroit public school system in the red right now, Noah?
Well, it depends on the day, Celeste, but today I believe it's about $316 million in the red.
That's a lot of change, and hopefully closing schools will bring them closer, but we don't know by how much?
This year alone, we're looking at a savings of $31 million with the closings. And, of course, over time, they're looking at several more millions being saved.
If I do my math right, that's still over $250 million of red ink. Noah Ovshinsky is an education reporter for WDET, our member station in Detroit.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee, and I'm here with John Hockenberry. John, have you ever been to a party and had somebody ask you an inappropriate question like, how much do you make, or how much did your house cost, or how much do you pay in interest rates?
I mean, at any party in the United States you go to, people go, so what do you do? You know,
they don't ask you how much your salary is?
Well, I mean, they don't necessarily quiz me on salary. Probably not, no.
Okay, well, there's a lot of things people will not talk about when it's related to money, as it turns out. People don't like talking about their personal finances. There's all kinds of negative feelings associated with it.
It's making me nervous.
A listener in Portland posts to our site, I find it difficult to discuss the fact my husband and I are not in financial distress. I feel guilty for our good fortune, although it's partly due to our conservative spending and investments, but I never tell my friends how much we make. So we're asking you, what will you not talk about? What is a taboo financial topic? Give us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we'll talk more about that in a few minutes. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. President Obama gets ready for another day of working on health care reform. He'll sit down with some wavering House Democrats today. That's as opponents run ad campaigns to kill the current bill. One senator quoted by the Associated Press says the frenzy over health care reform gives new meaning to March Madness. And in Mexico, the FBI says the hitman who shot three people with ties to a U.S. consulate in the country may have killed the wrong people.
Interesting story out of Germany. The German leader Angela Merkel says the 16 countries who use the euro currency should have the option of excluding a member state for financial reasons, presumably. Her comments are following the financial crisis in Greece, which Merkel has described as the greatest challenge yet for the euro. Big story here in the United States. The National Weather Service says there are floods threatening the Mid-Atlantic region and in the Dakotas. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Check your credit report.
Do it yourself.
Manage money.
Your income tax.
Where's your bailout?
Saving for college.
Negotiate the best price.
Where are we supposed to haggle?
Start saving.
Retirement.
Bailout.
Do it yourself.
Where's your bailout?
Do it yourself.
So for the past year, we've heard a lot about bailouts, bailouts for the car industry, bailouts for the American financial system. The big banks got a bailout. What happened to our bailout? Who's going to come in and bail out the average American citizen? Takeaway contributor Beth Koblenzer has an answer to that question. You are going to bail yourself out. We have a new series that we start today called Do It Yourself Bailout. It's a 10-part series. And this week, the question is, why can't we talk about money? Why is it so hard to talk about personal finances? It's just plain difficult. Keeping silent may be more comfortable, but it's also perhaps not healthy and certainly not good for your finances. Beth Koblenzer is author of Get a Financial Life. She's here to help us break this silence. Also with us, Stephen Goldbart, a psychologist and co-director of the Money, Meaning, and Choices Institute. Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
Good morning.
So Beth, first of all, let's kind of get an idea about this, because people come to you for answers, financial answers, right?
Right.
Are they agonized? I mean, what does it take to bring them to you?
Well, I think the main thing is we've all heard about this $11 trillion bailout. And I've been seeing people now wearing T-shirts saying, where's my bailout? And we see right now that there's 6 million Americans who have been unemployed for 6 months or longer, which is the longest period since the Bureau of Labor Statistics has been keeping this figure since 1948. So there's such a long period of time where people are out of work, and it's devastating for them. Meanwhile, they have $8,000 in credit card debt on average. 1 in 4 American homeowners are underwater, meaning they owe more than their home is worth. People have depleted their savings. And so we decided to do this takeaway bailout movement to get people up and learn about, you know, how to save. What are the secrets behind your credit score? How do you get out of debt? All those questions that you've asked me, everybody's asked me, and we're going to try to figure them out for people.
Okay, but Stephen, this is a question for you, because I was unemployed for just about 6 months. It was very, very difficult financially, and clearly I have a lot of house cleaning financially to do to recover from that, which I'm sure a lot of people are in that situation. And what I discovered when I started talking to my friends about this is that nobody wanted to talk about it. And when I finally did broach the subject, they were almost relieved to have a place to vent that. So what is this that makes us feel this personal shame over money issues?
Yeah, it's really true that money today is the issue that sex was maybe 50 years ago in terms of still being taboo and uncomfortable. And then when people just turn on the faucet, everyone's ready to just talk about it. That's because, in part, it's a lightning rod issue.
money is just loaded with emotional issues such as love, control, self-esteem, sexuality, and power. So it's very hard to have a conversation about money that's just about the money. People feel that when you ask them about money, you're asking them, you know, do you have or do you not have self-esteem? Have you made it? Are you likable? Are you dressed for success? You know, how well is your life going? In effect, in this country, money overdetermines, you know, who we are, our self-esteem, and what we are as people.
You know, Beth, I actually have a friend of mine who actually leaves her credit card bill sitting there until it's late because she doesn't want to open it, and she has the money to pay for it.
Yeah.
You must see people like this all the time.
Absolutely. You know, most people I know so little about it because they were never taught anything about it. But I have to say, personally, when I go to the doctor and I say I used to write for Money Magazine and the doctor says, oh, I love Money Magazine, I usually run the other way because I want my doctor to read JAMA. I don't want my doctor to read Money Magazine.
I agree.
I find people who are passionate about their careers or their families, we all have such busy lives. We don't really have that much time to focus on our money. It's not really all that fun. And we're busy doing so many other things. And those who do have time, you know, people are frightened. It is really overwhelming and scary to focus in on this topic that we don't know much about.
My wife and I have discovered that when you do it, mm-hmm. though, when you actually do get into it,
right.
it's actually, there's so much to talk about and so much to do there. It can be a bonding mechanism. It can actually be helpful.
Absolutely. That's the point.
You got to get over the hurdle.
You got to get over the hurdle. And I think the way to do that is by just diving in there, small steps at a time, like anything else in life. You get into the nitty gritty, you figure it out. And by talking about it, you really get to the nuggets of what we need to do as a couple or as
here,
a family.
Here, honey, here are my receipts. That's what we do.
That sounds so romantic.
But Stephen, you know, how do you get people to get over this fear of admitting things, of giving, even if they go to somebody like Beth Koblinder and they're trying to get their finances together, oftentimes I bet they don't even give her the whole story. They're embarrassed to tell her how bad they think things are. How do you get people over that?
Well, I think we first have to start by facing that we are uncomfortable with this and that work on separating our financial worth from our self-worth and say to ourselves, okay, you know, this is going to be hard, but I'm just going to take that first step to get started. You know, none of us have been taught to be emotionally intelligent about money, mm-hmm. and most of us have not been taught, you know, the financial basics, and the kind of holes that people find themselves in have a whole lot to do with the way in which our society has, you know, pressed us to buy, to purchase, to consume, but hasn't helped us understand what it means to manage our money. And another important point here, a conversation about money doesn't have to be boring. Ultimately, a conversation that you begin to have with yourself or with people in your life about money can be a conversation about what really matters to you most.
It's kind of 12-steppy
here. And the principles mm-hmm. that you want to have drive your life.
I'm John Hockenberry, and I bought an electric guitar in my 50s that I couldn't afford.
There we go. You say that. But also, I think a lot of it's about financial literacy. I often say to people, could you save $50 a month? They're like, no, I can't. It's impossible. I'm like, well, how about $2 a day? And they're like, oh, sure. Well, $2 a day. Of course I can. I'm like, well, you know what? If you can save $2 a day, you can save you can even save $60 a month. And they're like, oh, okay. You know, that kind of click. You know, a British study found that 1 in 7 people would say they prefer to visit a dentist rather than see a financial planner. So I feel like we're at this point.
How does that make you
feel,
Beth?
And that's the Brits. Yeah. I know. I think we're at the point where people are afraid, but perhaps the silver lining in this terrible economic situation that many people are feeling, and it's, you know, it's very serious and very grave, is that it's forced a lot of people to come to terms with, I'm in this dire situation. How do I get out of it? How do I pay attention to these issues at this very difficult time? And where do I start?
Do you generally find when people come to you, Beth, that things are worse than they think they are? Or do people generally think of themselves that they're in worse financial shape, they're in better financial shape than they thought?
I think, you know, as a journalist, I talk to people of all different ranges. But I think people are more scared, and it's this big, scary, you know, hole that they don't even want to go at and look at. And then when they look at the specifics, like, oh, I didn't realize, you know, it takes 3 phone calls and just to get it in order. Of course, it takes many, many years to pay off this debt. But once I'm on track, it's a little less scarier than I thought.
Well, Madoff was still scary, though.
I think we're missing out on a whole horror film genre here.
Indeed.
Beth Koblinder is author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s, and of course, we're a Takeaway contributor. And thanks to Stephen Goldbart, psychologist and wealth consultant, co-director of the Money, Meaning, and Choices Institute. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have trouble talking about finances, we want to know. Actually, my friend Ken posted to my Facebook, I hate the topic more than anything else, and it's a constant stressor in my marriage. Give us your stories at 8778-MY-TAKE. We're actually going to be following
keep
us.
Keep talking, Ken.
Beth has a list of tips for people who want to get their financial house in order, like me. You can check it out at our blog at thetakeaway.org. Next week, a list of priorities, setting priorities to get yourself out of debt.
Another bonus while you're there, we're asking you to help create the new Takeaway t-shirts. Here's some examples.
Give the other crooks a chance.
It's still better than John McCain.
The Takeaway almost always gives back.
So, think of a slogan, imagine it on a t-shirt, and give us your details at thetakeaway.org/t-shirt. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.